Welcome to Microdot Market Spaces today. Just as a reminder, before we begin, this material is presented solely for informational and entertainment purposes only and is not to be construed as a recommendation, solicitation, or an offer to buy or sell, long or short, any securities, commodities, or any related financial instruments. As always, please contact a licensed professional before making any investment or trading decisions. With that, today's guests, we have Andy Constant, Gary Broad, Peter Bookvart, Neely Tamiga, and Mike Green. So I'd love for this to be as roundtable as possible. So if you guys have anything to add to another's comments, please feel free to jump in. And with that, let's get to it. We'll start with Andy. First, you've been talking a lot about the QRA this week because we had a report on Monday and a report this morning. So can you talk about why these are important, what you look for, what does it mean for markets, and especially for those that may not watch it or know exactly how to interpret them?
Sure. Thanks for having me, Tracy. I think the high level point is that the quarterly refunding announcement is just information from the government about how it is going to issue securities to pay for its obligations, both it's the deficit it spends, the money it spends in excess of taxes, and any maturities of existing bills or coupons. And so this is a sleepy report for the past, for most of my career. I've been following it for 30 odd years. And it's sleepy because it really didn't matter much to markets at all. It was, it was very much something that the government bond professionals who were focused on, exactly what bonds were going to be issued, focused on. And then all of a sudden, since COVID, the flows of government financing have mattered a lot more because of the sheer size of both the issuance and the rapid change of composition that has occurred. And so I've been following it and tweeting about it for about 2 years now and think it has had some major impact on market prices upon the release. And I think the most important thing one can think about is that when the government issues something, someone has to buy it. And when they issue something risky, like a 30-year treasury bond, which, as we know from 2022, fell 35% in a single year, investors are more cautious and demand a larger reward for owning a 30-year bond than they do if, for instance, that same financing was done with a 2-year note or a T-bill. And so what I look for is the absolute size of the issuance and its composition. And so that answers that question. And to the extent that the composition is heavier in absolute size, that means that the private sector is being asked to absorb a lot of new issuance and have to lever up to do so. And to the extent that composition favors long-term bonds versus short-term bills, the impact is greater. And so over the last year, we've seen significant market moves upon the release of the QRA, the most notable being July, when total quantity and coupons for Q3 were significantly increased, and the equity and bond markets sold off harshly until Halloween. And then that reversed when the next QRA was released. Since then, both in February and today, the Treasury is issuing a lot of bonds and a lot of coupon bonds, a lot of bills too, but mostly coupon bonds. And that's been putting downward pressure on assets pretty much all year.
And was there anything notable in the reports, in the recent reports?
Yeah, the overall size of issuance was larger than expectations. The coupon issuance was in line with expectations. And the Treasury General account, which is the checking account that the government has, was increased in size, which takes out liquidity from the market without any spending. Just they keep it in the bank. There was a buyback announced, which was also in line with expectations. But when I add it all up, it was modestly more bearish assets than expectations. But there was also a very unusual crew of people who believed that there was going to be a massive liquidity injection when instead of the Treasury General account being increased in size, it would be spent down, which would be a huge liquidity injection, strong for the economy and strong for markets. Those same people also believed that they would cut coupon issuance, not increase coupon issuance. And so they were disappointed. And I think to some extent, the sell-off on Tuesday was the result of some disappointment in issuance. And that we're getting a little bit of a relief rally in bonds this morning on the actual news, and equities are still a little soft.
Excellent. Thank you. And we'll go over to Gary. Gary, you in your April newsletter, you go over the Fed dot plot, tracking the change in the Fed's opinion of future interest rates. So can you go over this a little bit? And I'll post the charts to Twitter that you'll be speaking about.
Yeah, thanks, Tracy. I appreciate it. So first of all, just take a minute and think about how ridiculous the whole situation is. The interest rate is the price of risk and the price of time. And instead of having that set by the market, we have it set by a collection of unelected bureaucrats who have never run a business. That itself is just kind of an insane way to run a financial market. But we took a look at the Fed's dot plots for the last few years. And it turns out the Fed is terrible at forecasting interest rates. And the most interesting part of that is they're the ones who control interest rates. So they make these forecasts, but when they get, you know, out 6 to 12 months later, actual interest rates, which they control, the Fed funds rate, don't match what they have put in their projections. And so, you know, if we take a look at 2022, just a year in advance, a year and a half in advance, they were off by about 400 basis points. And, you know, you could say, okay, well, 2022 was the year they started raising rates. They didn't expect to raise rates. First of all, they should have. This idea in the fourth quarter of 21 that anybody really thought inflation would be transitory and not tied to trillions of dollars of government stimulus is kind of silly. And, you know, if you're listening to this and you didn't know that, well, that's not silly. But if you're sitting at the, if you're the chairman of the Federal Reserve, that seems like the kind of thing you should know. But then if we go, you know, a year later to 2023, the Fed was wrong by more than 5% from the beginning of the chart. In that year, the committee was pretty close, about a year in advance, still not great, but better than in 22. And then when we look at this year, a really bad job by the committee, because at this point they knew, you know, inflation was not transitory. And these guys were off by more than 3%, 300 basis points to start. And even by the end of 22, they were still off by more than 1%. Now, we don't have the ending number for 24 yet, but it's pretty good bet. It's going to be close to where it is right now. And being off by more than 1% is a really big difference for an institution that tends to make 25 basis point incremental changes. So, you know, just to wrap up, I think it's kind of silly that we have an unelected committee determining the most important number in finance, but it's even nuttier that they have no idea, they have no ability to forecast what it's going to be.
Well, it always seems that they are a little bit behind the eight ball, right? So not completely surprising. Peter, you posted yesterday, I thought it was really interesting. If the economy is so good, believed by some, why are federal tax receipts coming in less than anticipated? Data seems very mixed. So what are you seeing right now, and where does this put the Fed?
Well, in all the years I've been doing this, I've never seen more mixed and uneven economic data and anecdotes. Anecdotes I'll define as diffusion indexes and what we're hearing directly from companies, particularly over the last couple of weeks with their earnings. For every pro, there's a con in this economy. So when I hear someone throw like a blanket statement about the economy, I just wince, whether, oh, the economy is strong or the economy is weak. I mean, and even with individual parts of the economy, you know, there are two different sort of lanes. Housing, existing home sales near 30-year lows, but home building doing better. Lower to middle income consumers on a tight budget, higher income consumers doing better. Trade around the world, pretty moderate. India growing 8%, China's growth slowing down, Germany in a recession, Southeast Asia doing okay. It's kind of dizzying. And I think it's really important to, you know, expand your economic analysis more than just these government statistics. And, you know, you look at even just today and you hear what Starbucks said and what McDonald's said, it was pretty striking. I mean, we're talking about selling coffee and cheeseburgers, and they're talking about, you know, strains in their business. I think that says a lot about at least parts of the economy that they're exposed to. You know, then on the industrial side, the ISM going back below 50, even though I think manufacturing around the world is trying to find some sort of a bottom, an inflection higher is not to be found just yet. So I think this is all makes for a very confusing picture. And if you're just going to look at the GDP report and say, okay, the economy is fine, I think that's a lot more mixed. And I think also adding to the confusion is all the, you know, the government influence on infrastructure and, of course, all the tax incentives and grants to build manufacturing facilities, whether it's making a chip or it's making a battery. I think that's certainly distorting things too, because then you hear some companies that are exposed to that, like Martin Marietta, which makes aggregates. They're doing fine in parts of their business, but they're not building new office buildings. Cousins Properties is a office REIT, and in their earnings call last week, I think they said that the construction of office buildings, and not a surprise to anybody, is near 40-year lows. Of course, who would in their right mind would build an office building right now? Of course. So there are just so many moving parts here that I think people need to dig under the hood when trying to figure out what's going on in the economy.
And then over to Neely. Okay, I had a Spaces with you a few weeks ago, and you had a May wild card for this decision today. One, can you explain what that is? And two, do you think it's still possible, being that the market is factoring in almost 100% chance of a pause?
Yeah, no, for sure, Tracy. The call that we made was really, and I build it that way, as it's a wild hair idea, not even a call, right? And it's that the May 10-year auction is how we determine the student loan, direct loan payment rate. So it's like a tiny little esoteric reality of how the government, you know, issues student loans, is they determine the rate once a year off the May 10-year auction. And so what we really posited at that point in time was, you know, are we going to have a situation where perhaps if Powell doesn't cut, does he make it clear about the direction of where the Fed's going to go? Because there are some serious budgetary implications if we issue that debt at a really high rate relative to last year. Especially when you think about what the CBO might have to do and reconciling the new SAVE programs and all the different, you know, the student loan kind of payments that the Biden administration has put into place. Every time you issue debt, you basically assume default, and the government will, in fact, back that default with all of the programs that are out there. So it was more looking at kind of the intricacies of fiscal implications off of a monetary decision more than it is like, oh, yeah, we think they're going to cut. But it is one, I think, still to be pondered. Will he be clearer than he has in the past because it has implications to the budget review, particularly over the summer months? It's something we're still thinking about. And then to Peter's point, we put it up in the nest. We've been wondering this exact same thing. We track like in a almost a neurotic way daily, you know, the tax refunds as well as the tax payments during tax season as people go through and reconcile their taxes. It is definitely a head scratcher as to why on a net basis we're actually tracking significantly lower on tax receipts into this reconciliation process at tax season for the government, in that last year, California didn't have to cut the check. This year they do. Optically, all things held constant, it actually should, you know, be more receipts into the coffers at this time. And it's a head scratcher, which definitely, I think, puts some validity to the idea that the jobs numbers have been, shall we say, a wee bit manufactured. So.
And with that, I want to kind of dig into this this employment issue with everybody. But first, I wanted to get Mike. I wanted to get your thoughts on the employment situation. Again, if you believe the BLS numbers, you know, we are starting to see a little bit of weakness in the labor market. You know, is it the next shoe to drop, and what does that mean for the Fed?
What I think it means to the Fed is I think the Fed is largely ignoring it at this point. I think that they have found themselves, people have referred to them as trapped. I think that, you know, they're not truly trapped. They're not bound in one direction or another. But they do certainly feel trapped by the court of public opinion, that if they were to start to cut, it would be perceived as incredibly political, which, you know, is a little bit strange. I've shared elsewhere, I'll try to put it up in the nest, the dynamics around inflation expectations has really been isolated effectively to a subset of the population that thinks inflation is running bananas. About 20% of the population in Michigan surveys says that inflation is running 10% or above for the next 5 to 10 years. Well above the levels that we even just saw in the 21-22 spike, those individuals appeared immediately upon Joe Biden's election. Obviously, there's a correlation there with the observed inflation, but I do think that a big chunk of what's going on is just people are pissed and angry, and that's showing up in a lot of the sentiment data that we're getting. On the unemployment front, look, I've been the biggest critic of the models of the BLS. I don't think that the BLS is actually engaged in a giant conspiracy. Candidly, you don't pay government officials enough money for them to really get involved in that sort of stuff. But the simple reality is that the models that they built prior to the COVID pandemic are not appropriate for the disruptions that have occurred in the aftermath of the pandemic. And so things like the birth-death adjustments are providing the majority of the jobs at this point. And I think we're just finding out that those are wrong, right? That the pace of job creation, the pace of new business formation is not nearly as rapid or as high quality as the models are suggesting. We know why that's occurring, but it's going to take time for them to adjust it. And that's why we're seeing consistently revised lower numbers.
And if anybody else wants to, I'm curious as to everybody's opinion kind of on this jobs data, because it seems like wage inflation is not keeping up with actual inflation. We are starting to see a slight uptick in unemployment. Again, we have consumer sentiment down and a rise in multiple job holders. So, you know, anybody feel free to jump in, because I like everybody's opinion on this.
It's Neely. I just want to weigh in. I do want to be specific with my words. I agree with Mike, and he knows I agree with him on this, that I don't think it's been like overtly manufactured, but I do think that there's been a lack of intellectual curiosity that could be better clarified than what is currently happening, you know, in that model. And in some ways, you can even go back to, you know, the conversations at the BLS, which they were fairly public about, even in how they were going to treat the consumer expenditure survey in which years they were going to include. They knew that this was going to be an issue, and they've known for a while. So that's really where my statement is coming from. But, you know, I think Mike and I agree on a lot more than we disagree on this. That said, I do think the other thing that needs to just be acknowledged is the implications. I mean, we're a little bit more in the weeds with companies and the decisions that they make. And I think you have a situation where CFOs created their budget you know, 110 days ago, they finalized it with their boards for 2024 at a time in a season when everyone thought you're going to have 5 to 6 rate cuts. And now it's like zero within 90 days while consumer demand is slowing. So whatever employment is, we think it's a bit on tenterhooks, and we think that there is the potential for a clearing out over the summer months and into fall.
Tracy, I might add a couple of things on this. I like the point that people are making right now about the BLS numbers are inaccurate and there are all these reasons. And I don't know that it matters so much whether it's intentional or not. They're not fixing it, which gets to the lack of curiosity that Neely was just talking about. But one of the things that I noticed that makes me suspicious and makes me think, hey, wait, you know, maybe there really is something going on here, is almost always when the government numbers are misreported, they're always misreported, almost always in one direction. The initial report always makes whatever the government's doing look better on the day that they announce when it gets a ton of attention. And then the revisions are quietly done later. And I get suspicious. Basically, if they were just inaccurate, then we would expect sometimes, you know, things to go in one direction, sometimes things to go in the other. But when 80 or 90% of the mistakes are in one direction, I get really suspicious on that. I also think some of this leads back to what you were saying, Tracy, where, you know, people are dissatisfied with the economy. And we keep seeing all these newspaper articles and Twitter posts or X posts that say, you know, hey, you Americans, why are you not more grateful for this wonderful economy that we have? But the truth is, the numbers that they cite to say the economy is great aren't real numbers, unless, you know, somebody wants to tell me that food inflation is really 2%. I guarantee you food inflation for an average family is not 2%. So when they're told the CPI is 2.5%, 3.5%, and that their expenses are only up that much, they know that's not real. And they know that the job growth is more people working, the same people working more jobs as opposed to more people working full-time jobs. So I think there are reasons people are not happy with the situation. And I think it's really interesting the number of newspaper writers who are chastising the American people for a lack of gratitude.
So I think this is Mike Green. I think there's some truth, particularly to the last statement that you made. And I've made a point of this, highlighting how far we've come from 1992's campaign, which was, it's the economy, stupid, to today, it's, you're stupid, the economy is fine. I think that's part of the reason why people are so angry. But I also think that there's a degree of disingenuousness that is coming from the inflation data. And I'll just give a really simple example of that. So actually, if we look, and certainly my individual experience, and I shop on a very regular basis, literally almost daily, is that food prices are actually flat to down versus last year for the most part. Things like eggs, things like milk, things like standard grocery supplies are actually down on a year-over-year basis. Over the past 3 or 4 years, they're up about 25%. People don't buy ketchup every single time they go to the grocery store, and so the price changed last year, and I'm just now replacing the ketchup. I'm like, wow, that's crazy. I can't believe I'm spending $5 instead of $4 for ketchup. But the idea that the BLS is lying about the food price inflation, to me, is just somewhat silly. I understand why that happens. I understand why people perceive that. I'm not saying that they're dumb. I'm just saying that there is actually a different data set. And so it's really hard when we turn around and say the data is fake, because it's not. It just doesn't necessarily interpret in the same way that people want to hear it.
That, Mike, that's a very fair point. And one area where I really do agree with you on this is economists like to make their arguments in terms of rate of change and disinflation. Most citizens live off of price levels. So I think that's consistent from both a psychological and a data point for what you're saying.
Tracy, yeah. This is Peter. Can I chime in for a second?
Absolutely.
We have to keep in mind when the jobs number comes out, it's coming out a few days after the month ends. To think that the BLS is going to have all the right information a couple of days after the month ends, even though the survey period ends in the middle of the month, it's just impossible for them. And that's why we have revisions and multiple revisions and an annual revision. And it takes time. That's why I actually think ADP has a skill set in that they actually have payroll slips in hand. But I think the result is you need to look at a broader measure of the jobs data, whether it's anecdotal hearing from companies' hiring trends. I mean, look at the NFIB survey. Plans to hire continues to drop. We had the JOLTS data today. The hiring rate, even though it's as of March, so it's somewhat dated, not including COVID, fell to a 10-year low. So you got to expand your analysis in looking at more than just what the BLS tells you. You need to look at a lot of different things, and even continuing claims, initial claims, and whatever. And the ISM, the S&P Global, which their last report on services talked about a notable slowing on the services side. So to me, there's a clear slowdown in the demand for workers. Companies, though, are still reluctant to lay off people because it was so hard to bring them on staff over the past couple of years. But the trend is clearly to a moderating labor market. Now, I think what's also throwing some distortion into this is all the immigration, because whether you're illegal or legal, you're getting a work permit. And I think that that's adding to some of the cross currents in terms of the jobs numbers. In the Treasury issuance report a couple of days ago, there was a Treasury official that said, we need to now hire 200,000 people a month, up from 100, just to absorb the increase in the size of the labor force. So this is not your usual labor market. With some of these different sort of flowing trends and data points mixing in, that confusing the situation, getting to my original point on how confusing the overall economy seems to be when analyzing it.
Absolutely. Andy, do you have anything to add about the labor market? If not, I want to kind of move on to the buzzword of stagflation. Can't hear you. Andy? Are you there? Okay. We're just hearing silence for some reason. So we'll go to, Mike. So the buzzword lately is stagflation. A lot of people are saying higher for longer. You know, what does this mean for markets? And, you know, in the face of kind of some deteriorating data, you know, is the pendulum going to swing the other direction? By that, I kind of mean, you know, we had this dovish tone turn in December, this 180 by the Fed, and markets priced in, you know, 6 rate cuts across the year. Markets went crazy, and now we're down to like 1.2 maybe, and now people are talking about raising rates. So now that the pendulum swung the other way around and we're seeing deteriorating data, do we get cuts this year?
Well, again, I think, you know, I think it was Gary was referring to this earlier, and I think it's a really valid point, right? Ultimately, rates are set by the Fed. It's an individual primarily that is appointed, not elected, that is deciding the price of the front end. And the front end ultimately has to drive the behavior of the back end to the extent prices are actually set. I think the market is already telling you that they think interest rates are way too high. I think that's what an inverted yield curve means, is that the Fed has hiked rates to a level that is actually unsustainable, and the curve is reflecting expectations that it'll be cut in the future. The problem is, it's just like your parents being super serious about a punishment. You know, you sit there for an extended period of time saying, like, are you serious? Are you really going to do this? Is this really what you're going to, like, am I really grounded? Do you really mean that? Can I really not drive the car? Well, fine, then you're going to have to drive the car to get me places to go, right? There's this negotiation process with a very firm parent that effectively kicks in. That's not dissimilar to what you see happening on the curve. And if the Fed is perceived as going to stay higher for longer because they don't see an imminent need to cut, then the curve has to reprice to reflect that expectation of the future rates. I think that's the key in terms of what's ultimately going on. We're not debating what needs to be done economically. We're debating what the Fed is going to do in the face of the economics. And individuals like Andy have been spot on in terms of the Fed has not had the incentive structure to cut yet. Do I think that's going to change? Not until I think there's a substantive change in the underlying behavior. I think the right answer is that interest rates are way too high. I think we're seeing that. I think it's important for people to remember that there is no one interest rate that is right, quote unquote. There's no such thing in the economy. My interest rate is going to be different than your interest rate. A levered small business that just got itself started and needs to put in new equipment is going to have a very different cost of capital than Apple. And their ability to access debt is increasingly impaired. That's why we're seeing surging levels of bankruptcy for small business. I think the problem is, and I'm actually interviewing Peter Atwater on our Keeping It Simple podcast later this month, we have a bifurcated economy where one segment of the economy has very high returns on capital, very low needs for cash, and another segment of the economy actually has extraordinary needs for it. And the tension between those two is what we're going to ultimately have to monitor. So I think this is the really critical component, right? Are 0% rates the right level? No. Are 6% rates the right level? No. Are there some people who would be ecstatic with 6% rates? Yes, we call them baby boomers. Are there some people who would be ecstatic with 0% rates? Yes, we call them young people, right? And so you end up in this weird place where, you know, when an economy is bifurcated like this, there is no right policy. There's just a series of choices, some of which I think are worse than others.
And Peter, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, are you worried about, you know, we've seen CPI and PCE prints have both come in above expectations and above the prior month over the last few months. So, you know, is this a worry? And, you know, does this kind of put the Fed in a pickle?
Well, you know, it's important to slice and dice the inflation data, even though the Fed focuses on what the print tells them. On the good side, we're actually back to the pre-COVID trend of basically zero year over year. I don't think it necessarily stays here. I think that there's some signs that it's probably going to lift again. But overall inflation is typically on the service side. I mean, services inflation is never transitory. The 20 years leading into COVID, it averaged just shy of 3% services inflation ex energy within CPI. Offset by, as I said, goods prices being zero. And that's how you got to your 1% to 2% inflation. Now, of course, we had the cyclical rise in goods prices that have since reversed, and services inflation that continues on, but because of slowing rents as the year progresses, will eventually show itself up. I think the Fed is sort of stuck if inflation just hangs around this, call it 3% level. Yeah, maybe in the back half of this year, we'll see the 2% prints again, and everyone thinks that everything is fine. But I think that inflation, if it remains stuck around 3-ish, then that means that the days of zero rates and QE and the Fed's ability to react to externalities is much more limited. I think the one good thing from what we're seeing now is negative rates, zero rates, is sort of being repudiated. The Bank of England yesterday updated their quarterly loss expectations from QE. It's going to cost the UK taxpayer now £85 billion instead of £80 billion in losses. We know the Fed is bleeding every day with paying out more in interest on reserves than they are taking in. But to the real question is, what does this mean for the Fed? Yeah, it hamstrings their ability to respond here. And Mike is right. And the point I've been making is it's an extraordinarily bifurcated economy. And when we debate, is the Fed restrictive or not? Well, they're restrictive for some, particularly if you're in the commercial real estate business and you're praying for Fed help. But on the other hand, if you're deriving interest income at 5%, you're feeling good, as we're seeing with the cruise line business and the desire to travel with your interest income instead of tapping into your savings. And how the Fed... But this is what the Fed's issue is all the time, because when they were easing, they were crushing the savers, but trying to bail out the banks and trying to help people refinance offside loans. So there's always a trade-off when it comes to this. And to what the point Gary made earlier, you know, it would have been nicer if the market is setting the cost of money instead of a bunch of bureaucrats trying to figure out what the price of money is. But, you know, it is what it is in the system that we're in. But in terms of where the right Fed funds rate is, I mean, before the great financial crisis, the normal real rate, the Fed funds relative to inflation was 250, 300 basis points. So you can argue that's where we are now. Now, of course, it's on a much higher level of debt. It's not the same sort of macro backdrop, but 250 basis points of real rate used to be normal. And when and I do want to use this as an opportunity, and then I'll pass it back. When I hear R star, my head explodes because there's no such thing as R star. It's just a Fed-generated econometric model spit out based on whatever input they put in, spits out this output. So there's no real R star. And even Powell himself said it doesn't really, the proper number doesn't really exist. And you only know it when you see it.
Thank you. And we got Andy back. So Andy, I would love your thoughts on this too, please. Are you there? You have to unmute yourself. Okay. Hello?
Tracy, if you go back to another old white guy again, I'm going to be really upset here.
Okay. Neely, we'll go to Neely.
There we go.
To,
I like it.
Good. We're trying to get Andy. What I know that you guys look really dig into the weeds on the data. So I want to hear kind of your what you're really focused on when you're looking at the economy right now, and what are some of the data points that have you maybe a bit worried, or that you think are fine.
You know, we do. So, you know, just for a little bit of background, I was global head of consumer research over at Piper Jaffray, which is now Piper Sandler, for many years. And we've spun off in the last 8 years as our own kind of private consultancy on the consumer economy. So we're kind of like, you know, stand-in economists for consumer brands, effectively. And so we get very much into the weeds. And I think I completely stand the idea that we're, you know, a bifurcated economy. I think it's more than just two. I think it's more than just bi. It's probably quadfurcated, if we're really to kind of think through both the lens of consumers' capacity to spend as well as their willingness and where they are in certain life stages. I think people are making choices around, you know, do they have children? Do they not? Do they buy a house? Do they not? Like, who are these people? I mean, the Journal did an awesome story not too long ago, and a trend we've totally picked up in our role as a professor, because we also teach. And more of these Gen Zers are going on vacations with their grandparents because their grandparents have the cash and they don't have the oversight that their parents have. So, you know, there's all sorts of ways that consumers are maximizers. And we think that that's beautiful. And that, but that beauty of consumer maximization can cause confusion. Let me give you a quick case in point. Something that we've been not overly glib about, but actually something very real. When people are like, how can McDonald's underperform? How can Starbucks underperform? Domino's does well, Chipotle does well. You know, is it around choice? Is it around, you know, day part? The reality is it's actually very simple. When you talk to consumers, $10 can stretch into two meals at a Chipotle. $10 can stretch into two meals at Domino's. $10 is precisely one meal at McDonald's, and it is precisely one pink drink right over at Starbucks. So we do think that the consumers are maximizing within the choicefulness of, you know, different consumption categories. And that's where the alpha can be made, is really understanding that consumer first sort of approach. But we are, I would say, high level January and February were underperformers. January, first and foremost, difficult compares, plus some weather events, plus you didn't quite have the capacity boost from the COLA adjustments the prior year as you did, or this year as you did the prior year. So that was a contributing factor. In February, the way the timing of tax refunds worked, it was unfavorable to the consumer's capacity to spend on tax refunds this year versus the prior year. It turned to favorability. That was confirmed in all the earnings calls on Q4 among consumers, that the, you know, week one, week two of March started to improve on a relative basis to where they were in February. We saw that come through in retail sales overall. And then in April, it has been that has held, you know, on a net basis, and that's up in the nest, that net of taxes owed or paid, we're still tracking ahead of last year on the consumer's capacity to spend for the month of April. But even with that headline, there's choicefulness behind that. So, yeah, you got to think through the lens of the consumer. Just talk to them.
Are you concerned at all? You know, I mean, you have Visa and MasterCard both say they had, you know, increased credit card spending. But we have interest rates in credit cards at 21.59%, like an all-time high. And then we have delinquency rates creeping up past pre-pandemic levels, but lower than historical norms. So is this all a worry at all? Are people just putting... In other words, are we doing, you know, discretionary kind of consumer spending on credit cards, or are they spending on groceries?
You know, they are making choices. And I think Ulta's most recent release, you know, was evident of that. It's kind of been an untouchable stock in a category that's been strong. And, you know, they themselves were talking about how consumers are making different choices. If you think about the composition of their consumer, they're very likely over-indexed to the buy now, pay later crew. And that's a missing piece. It's one of the areas that we continue to search for more clarity around. The information and the data is not reflective in the government data, you know, by the way, on the credit usage on buy now, pay later in the Fed kind of credit reporting, et cetera. And buy now, pay later was substantially used over the holiday season. And you saw some of that spending pullback in January as a result of being overextended and having to make payments on those loans, those little micro consumer loans. We think that the same is happening. So could it be that the pullback on the buy now, pay later is actually somewhat of a canary in the coal mine dynamic on the broader credit card, you know, sort of usage statistics? It's something we're looking at. How short or how long is the runway of the buy now, pay later customer? Something we're in constant exploration of right here, right now. And I think the other point on delinquency, which is just incredibly important to keep be mindful of, is we have got 26 million recipients of student loans payers that are currently in repayment. We have more that are not in repayment, or we have additional ones, not more than 26 million, but we have additional people who are not in repayment. Not one of those people are having their credit delinquencies on their non-payment of student loans being reported into any of the agencies right now. So that is something to be mindful of whenever you look at any of the delinquency numbers. We're still not back to stasis. So something to be thinking.
That makes sense.
Neely, can I just add something to that? I think also what is impacting consumer psychology right now and the tight budget that they're on is if you look at the answers to the labor market questions in the consumer confidence number this week, jobs hard to get, plentiful jobs and jobs hard to get are softening again. So the consumer is actually getting more worried about the ability if they did lose their job. And we also saw this in New York Fed Consumer Expectation Survey, that they're getting a little more nervous about the state of the labor market, and that if they do lose their job, they're more worried about their ability to find a new one. And obviously we saw that with the job openings number. So I think that also is creating a sense of fragility. Then you throw in the savings rate, which is very low. That just from a sort of a jobs outlook perspective could be another reason why consumers are just playing it close to the vest in terms of their spending.
I might add one thing to that as well. You guys are all talking about a bifurcated economy, or nearly saying trifurcated. I completely agree, but the way that I might think about that difference isn't so much in terms of old versus young, but more in terms of private versus government. You know, Tracy originally brought up the idea of stagflation. I think we're going to see higher for longer in both inflation and interest rates. The real economy, I think, is facing stagflation, but the official economy, it won't happen simply because of government spending. We've got all this wild stimulus. If you look at last quarter, growth in GDP was $328 billion. Growth in federal debt was about $500 billion. So the government spending is basically creating the outcome they want. That's going to continue. Nobody in Congress is going to cut spending and risk running for re-election during a recession. So we won't officially hit recession, but I think there's a huge difference right now between the private economy and what the government is doing. And by the way, when we've talked a lot about full-time jobs versus part-time jobs, it's also worth mentioning that a huge percentage of all the new jobs added have been either in government or in healthcare, which is largely funded by government. And then my last point in all this is, you know, there's a lot of talk about whether the current Fed funds rate is restrictive. You know, I know people on this call have said it, that Powell has said it in press conferences. But I think they're in a tough spot. It's very tough for them to cut rates when the government is spraying trillions of dollars of stimulus into the economy and they don't have inflation completely under control.
Do we have Andy back at all? Just wanted to get...
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, finally. All right. So I'd like your thoughts on this, your thoughts and your thoughts on, you know, stagflation and, you know, what do you think the Fed is going to say today?
Yeah, so, well, I guess I would say the first, there was 15 minutes in there when we were talking about, when everyone was talking about data being manipulated, false, blah, blah, blah. That is completely does every investor a disservice. It's a complete waste of time, unfortunately. And thankfully, I got kicked off, so I couldn't have been even more nasty in that comment. But more importantly, when we come back to actually what's going on in the economy is a single economy. It isn't bifurcated unless you're trying to create issues around individual stocks or the impact on individual market cohorts within that economy. The economy overall is doing fine. Inflation is a little bit more sticky than we would like. And so we're in a situation where the Fed is has not actually had restrictive rates. The front end rate is high and is restrictive from a real standpoint, which is the math approach that the Fed has been using, mistakenly used in before. And now they're paying for that by a warming up of the economy in the first half of this year. What isn't restrictive is the rate that matters to the economy, which is the long-term interest rate. And until long-term interest rates stay high for a medium period of time, my view is 3 to 6 months, but maybe longer, the economy is not going to roll over and inflation isn't going to come back down to target. And so my view is that we are now in that period of time in which the significant supply of treasuries has caused long-term interest rates to rise 75 basis points over the last, since the lows of interest rates in December. And that's beginning to tighten the economy, and the economy needs that to stay high for a few months before we see any real sign of the economy turning. And when it does, I think it's going to be very difficult for the Fed to offset the weakening by monetary policy. And so if that were to occur, I think we'll end up in a fairly meaningful recession. When? Sometime in late 24, early 25. Yes, I know there's an election. But the die is cast as it relates to high interest rates. And so for me, the question about the Fed will be, are they willing to fight what they believe to be this renewal of inflation enough to keep interest rates higher? And the only way they can do that is by maintaining the short-term rate, because they have no control over the long-term rate. They passed that to Janet Yellen. So I think that's how it plays out. Today's Fed meeting, they're not going to change interest rates. They're unlikely to do anything in terms of signaling the June hike cut, because the probability of a June hike is almost zero in markets right now, so they have nothing to do. And so they're going to remain data dependent. And we'll see the SEP come next Fed meeting. And then the only question is, will they taper QT? I don't think it matters much, and they should begin tapering QT relatively soon. But I think they'll delay that decision for another meeting.
Do you think at all that they'll be politically pressured in any way to kind of lower rates, even though they're independent, blah, blah, blah? But, you know, there are, you know, a lot of people are thinking that they are going to lower rates. They can't in September because that would be too close to the actual election. So, you know, somewhere in July, if they're going to.
I think the political narrative is absolutely useless for investors. Those same people who are saying that the Treasury Secretary would spend down the TGA and cut coupons are the same people that are saying that the Fed can't cut in, that are timing the election around the Fed actions. The Fed will do what needs to happen at the time it needs to happen without concern to politics. And the politicians don't even know what's good for them. What's good for the politicians is killing inflation. So I think, no, that's a complete tin hat sort of way too much emphasis on politics as it relates to policy. And I see no signs that the Fed or the Treasury has been particularly political in their decision making over the course of the last year.
And then I know we're kind of sort of coming up on the hour, but I kind of wanted to touch on the real estate market really quickly with all of you. We had commercial real estate foreclosures up 117% over the past year. So that market still looks kind of shaky, to say it in a nice way. And then now we have mortgage rates creeping back up again. So, you know, is this going to be a headwind for the economy? And is this something we should really be focused on? Or is it a big nothing burger? Whoever wants to go first, jump in there.
Tracy, it's Peter. First of all, I just want to push back for a second on Andy's point that the economy is fine. It's like saying in the late 90s, the economy is fine because, you know, tech stocks are up. And in 2006, the economy is fine because housing is doing well. An economy that's heavily reliant on government spending is not fine, because once that road is finished, once that bridge is finished, once that manufacturing facility is finished, we'll have to see what happens, because an economy that's continuously reliant on excessive government spending is not really fine. There are holes because the multiplier effect on government spending is typically below one. So it's not a healthy economy. In terms of commercial real estate, it's a $20 trillion asset class. Now, there's a lot of equity within that $20 trillion, but if you are and I'm just stating the obvious here, if you priced a loan pre-2022 at around 3%, it's repricing at 8 to 10%. So you need to come up with more equity. Now, it's not something that brings down the financial system. Plenty of banks are going to see some stress, and we'll see more bank failures, but I think it will be dealt with. But if you're in commercial real estate, there's going to be amazing opportunities for distressed buyers, and there's going to be a lot of difficulty for anybody that has debt coming due this year or next year.
Yeah, I just want to refine my comment. When I say the economy is fine, it is fine right now. Do I think the economy is going to remain fine? Absolutely not. The conditions that are set up in the significant amount of flows of government spending, the leverage in the pricing of asset markets are going to be extremely difficult for policymakers to do something that will cause a soft landing. And yet, soft landing prices prevail across the investment world. So, no, I don't think the economy will be fine. I think it's fine now.
Do you think the Fed, does that mean that you think that something's going to break before the Fed does anything about it, being behind the eight ball?
No, I'm not a break guy. And the reason why I'm not a break guy is that the financial system, banks in particular, the providers of credit are, you know, with a small CRE exposure, which, you know, that's already pretty heavily discounted, both in the real market in terms of prices of these things and within banks' balance sheets. But I don't see the potential for a bank blow up. So I don't think it's going to be one of these. The reason why the economy has been so strong for 2 years is because the banking system, the financial system, is very robust, except on the edges. And because there's no systemic risk to the banking system, it's been very difficult. And the market has gone on wild runs because everything's fine. And only by keeping interest rates high for a long period of time are we going to get the sort of economic reaction that happens when you have an economy that needs to cool down, but isn't going to cool down suddenly with some sort of credit event.
Andy, can I ask you a question on that? You know, 2 years ago, the government actually took an adjustment very quietly in their budget, their monthly budget, for defaults on the EIDL loans. Even though the EIDL loans are at low rates themselves, it doesn't encompass the fact that these small businesses have other loans. And I think they were identified at about, 13% or so of the small businesses overall in the nation had some form of the EIDL loan. Do you think that there is, you know, when you're looking for where things are going to fall apart, do you think it's in that small business sort of data set? Because that's actually really hard outside of NFIB. It's actually pretty hard to capture what's going on. Like, where do you think it's going to come from?
Yeah, I think I'm not for me, looking at the edges of whether it's credit card debt and defaults or corporate defaults or what you're just describing, I'm not one of those people who thinks that the quantity of those things matter. It's the market cap of those things that matter. And so our economy is becoming more dominated by bigger companies and is vulnerable to them breaking and not the Russell 2000 or small businesses breaking. Russell 2000's entire market cap is the size of Microsoft, actually less than the size of Microsoft. So you have to just wonder whether there's so I don't think these things become systemic. That said, in terms of what you've described as the bifurcated economy, I think there's going to be some serious pain and potential social upheaval as certain classes, certain cohorts experience significant pain.
I think what Andy is saying is actually an important distinction. And I think there's this language dynamic that often defined the interactions between Keynes and Hayek, in which Keynes bemoaned the imprecision of Hayek's language, right? But at the end of the day, they deeply respected each other's intelligence and capability. So when Andy says the economy is fine and then says, I think there's going to be catastrophic outcomes, I think we're all saying very similar things. It's not healthy to have an economy become as sensitive and reliant on the mega cap names, because what you're really building there is a fragile system where if the equivalent of, Barclays Bank collapses, it takes down the UK banking system in total. If JP Morgan were to collapse, which I do not anticipate it would, it would take down the US banking system in a manner that would make Lehman look like nothing at this point, because we've consolidated things to such an extraordinary degree. It's not healthy that the Russell 2000 is now only 4% of the US market cap. All these sorts of things, I think we're all ultimately saying the same thing. But what Andy is saying, and I think this is actually something that is really important, is distinguishing between risk and systemic risk. And I think a lot of people point correctly to things like, oh, look at this risk, right? Myself included. for things to become systemic, it basically means that there is no alternative. And so for some of these things, I think the word, you know, crisis, systemic, et cetera, gets tossed around an awful lot. And where those risks really exist, I think actually we often don't do a very good job of identifying those components. Particularly, this is why you hear me talk about things like passive investing all the time, because the liquidation of those assets would truly be systemic. The loss of the asset value in an environment in which a large fraction of our future spending expectations are built around those asset levels, that's really systemic. If I look at housing, for example, do I think it's systemic in the way that it was in 2006? No, I don't. Do I think it could fall? Absolutely. So I think there's, it was very helpful, Andy, to hear you explain what you were saying. I just wanted to try to add to that. I don't know if it was helpful for other people.
I think you nailed it, Mike. And I think what you act, the last thing you said about the mega caps, the way the economy slows is the purchasing power that has been created by the mega caps. The ability to lever your equity, the wealth effect of owning these equities, that is what the Fed has to target, or else the economy will continue to run hot. And to do that, you have to increase long-term interest rates and have these stocks fall. And so this is an economy that, exactly as you describe, depends on those asset values retaining their premium. And as long as they do, the economy runs hot. And when they don't, the question will be, how do you turn it and how does it play out as these mega caps fall?
Yeah, and I might say it slightly. So this is actually part of my objection, because the use of interest rates is not the only tool that they have available, right? They could actually engage in activities that they've done before, which is effectively regulatory frameworks that reduce the use of leverage, that make high valuation stocks less marginable. You could certainly engage in policy decisions. I think this is one of the reasons why I'm much more supportive of what Lina Khan is doing than many of my peers. You can reduce risk in other ways. By hiking that interest rate, you're exacerbating the problems that Peter Buchvar and I were both talking about, where there is not one right interest rate for the economy. And so paradoxically, we're destroying small business, even as we're bemoaning the fact that small business is not, you know, is supposed to be the future, right?
Yeah, the short-term interest rate may be too high, and that's the only lever they feel they seem to be willing to pull. I'm not focused on that rate. I think you might be right that it's too high. What I know for a fact is the long-term interest rate is not high enough.
So I that's, to me, that is a contingent statement. Right. If the Fed is committed to maintaining interest rates at the short end at these levels, then you're 100% right. Right. The future period component, the non-arbitrage dynamics around the individual payments, has to reflect that higher interest rate. If that happens, then I think the economy is in a much worse shape than it currently is. Right. That's exactly the point that I was making. Like, if the Fed, you know, imagine you've got a crazy emperor, right? They could set the price of money whatever they want, and you can argue about it all you want. They're not going to change it. Think Erdogan. Right. In this case, I think I disagree with you. I think the interest rate at the front end is too high, and I think that that is contributing to the dynamics of the back end rising, even as we're watching housing and other assets that are dependent on those rates effectively saying this is just too high.
Yeah, we just agree on, I mean, we agree on the front rate, and we just disagree on what drives the back rate. I think it's the risk-adjusted return of owning long-term bonds plus inflation expectations and long-term growth expectations, and none of them are high enough to restrict the economy, in my opinion. But, you know, again, you're right, the forward rate does matter. and the front end does matter. It's actually done, you know, it's been 2 years now we've been inverted, and it really hasn't lifted long-term rates.
I actually don't entirely agree with that. I think the narrowing, the bear steepening that you're seeing is actually largely evidence of the fact that the Fed is slowly pulling it up. But I think others correctly, like George Robertson, while I think he's got interesting characteristics to him, is largely correct. The economy can operate at any level of interest rate. It just, the transition process of getting there is terrible. And the end equilibrium is going to be very different than an optimal one.
Peter, did you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I agree with both Andy and Mike in terms of the influence that the stock market has in the economy. I mean, if you're an economist that's going to try to predict where the economy is going to go in the next couple of years and throw out a recession forecast, you actually also have to have a prediction of where the S&P goes. Because with the lower-income consumer already in a fragile state, you know, the S&P 500 goes to 3,000, you can be sure and guarantee we're in a global recession. So that has a direct influence on economic activity and even the spending of the boomers. You know, I'm the CIO of a wealth management firm. I see what boomers own. And yes, they're benefiting from higher interest income on their savings, but they also own a lot of stocks. So you get a decline in the stock market, it will directly flow through consumer spending on the higher end, where the top 20% quartile spends about 40% of all consumer spending.
I'll just toss in actually another interesting anecdote, which I use my mother-in-law, who's done phenomenally well. I'm very happy for her as an example of many of these things. Was speaking to her yesterday. She's actually looking to reduce her equity exposure and roll into bonds because she wants more income associated with it and less risk. And when I asked her how much equity she had, she thought she only had about 25% equities. And I said, that strikes me as absurd given what you told me your return was last year. We actually walked through her portfolio. She's about 70% equities, right? She wasn't counting things like her mutual funds that are equities. She was only looking at the individual equities in her portfolio. I don't think that's uncommon. I really don't.
Neely, did you have anything to add to that?
Just one final thing that you originally asked about commercial real estate. And I agree with a couple of people have said, hey, this could be bad, but it's not going to take down the whole economy. I agree with that. And I forget who it was. It might have been Michael or Peter. Used the word social upheaval. And the thing that I'm thinking on that is I really hope that as we move our way through some of the difficulties in commercial real estate, the government actually lets some of these banks fail and let some of these real estate companies fail. Because I do think that if there's another bailout, you know, just a decade and a half after the last one, I think people are going to get upset. And I don't want to see that. I also think we need to have some sort of failure for excessive risk taking, because otherwise the amplitude of these boom and bust cycles gets insane. And when people aren't punished for taking ridiculous risk, they're going to keep doing it again and again and again. And the bailouts are going to keep getting larger. So I'm hoping that won't be the case this time. I don't have a lot of optimism on that, but that's sort of my wish.
Well, we kind of just had a bailout, sort of, if you know, at the last spring with the regional banks. So, you know, I feel like whatever happens, they're going to step in to soften the blow, so to speak, you know, as much as possible, I believe, even though they'll let I do believe they want some regional banks or more regional banks to fail, to be honest. Did you have any thoughts to add, Neely?
You know, I echo the comments made by Mike and by Peter. We see it too. Boomers are over-indexed to equities. I can case study all day long when big drops in markets happen, how retail sales pullback happens literally the next month, largely because boomers perceive their wealth on time horizon and not just volumes and levels. So I would just make the point that that perception of their wealth is not actually in their absolute dollar. It's the fact that they're no longer employed and they have a limited time horizon. So that's just something to be thinking of.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then really, I know that we're a little bit past the hour and I don't want to take up too much of your time. So I just kind of want to go around and kind of talk about, you know, something that we should be really focused on right now, whether that's in terms of the markets or in terms of the Fed or in terms of, you know, what you think Paul is going to speak to today. And we'll just go around. We'll start with Mike, then Andy. I'm just going around in the order I have you guys on my screen right now. So we'll start with Mike, then Andy, then Peter, then Neely, then Gary. Oh, and Mike looks like he just dropped. So we'll, Andy, you go up. You're up. You know, what should we really be focusing on right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to focus on the mechanics in the way that asset values long-term asset values influence the economy, and not the other way around. And that as time goes on, to the extent that the markets, for whatever reason, have sustained high asset values, the economy will be fine. And then think about what happens in the other case and how policymakers will have to react, knowing that the idea of going to ZERP and doing QE is going to be extremely unpopular.
That makes sense. And Peter.
So I agree with what Andy said about asset prices. I mean, that really goes back to Greenspan, where he believed in the wealth effect and manipulating asset prices to drive the economy rather than the economy driving asset prices. I think the Fed meeting today will actually be somewhat uneventful, because Powell's not going to really is in no position to commit to any policy change. And I think we also have to understand that just keeping interest rates, I know we, everyone throws out the cliche of higher for longer, but it really matters because of the maturities that take place in the corporate bond market over the next couple of years, is that you can just keep interest rates where they are. And that itself is a continuous form of tightening, because every day somebody's pre-2022 loan is coming due. Some businesses, some households can handle that better than others. When I say household, because there's still people out there that probably took out a 10-year ARM 10 years ago, and it's coming due this year. So I'm more worried about sort of a death by a thousand cuts situation rather than any broad deterioration that will lead to like an 08 thing. Now, that said, like I said earlier, if the stock market really takes a hit and we go into another bear market that takes us much lower, you know, that would be a real problem, because if inflation still remains, you know, somewhat sticky in that kind of environment, the Fed's going to have less ability to save us, and that the days of them doing a massive QE and cutting rates to zero, I think they're just going to be much more limited in their ability to address our next problem, whether that's a decline in the stock market or a rise in the unemployment rate.
And Neely.
Just watch the 10-year auction and just know that the implications are significant, you know, and not just in its normal course, but in the fact that it will price the new issuance of direct loans for student loans. And with new policies in place, that will have a direct impact on how that will get translated by the CBO on the on recalibrating the deficit and what the levels that we need for the government to be running. So that there's a longer tail implication to the 10-year auction.
Excellent. And Gary.
So in this conversation, Tracy, we've all been focused on interest rates for this discussion. I just point out that endless overspending in Congress always is going to lead to more inflation. all fiat ends up going to zero. And where we are right now, we're basically printing to pay interest on what we just printed. But as depressing as all that is, there are things that can be done to deal with this. I'd like certain selected stocks. There are still good values in the stock market. You know, not everything is overpriced right now. Beyond that, there are great opportunities in energy, things like oil and uranium. We've spoken about that a lot. Gold and Bitcoin are great dollar alternatives. So, you know, even though a lot of this conversation, a lot of the things I've said have been, you know, negative or pessimistic, that doesn't mean everything has to be bad for your portfolio. There are ways to manage this kind of risk.
Excellent. And on that note, I want to thank everybody for speaking today. I know your time is very valuable. And I know I appreciate it. I know the audience appreciates it. So with that, everybody go hurry up and get some lunch before the Fed. And I'll see everybody next Wednesday. Again, I appreciate you guys. Thank you so much.